Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Appalachia voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. He won 95% of the counties here, and Trump did better in Appalachia than previous Republican candidates. But that doesn't mean everyone here is happy with the results. On today's show, we're going to hear from different people in our region. They'll talk about their hopes and fears surrounding Trump. We'll also take a closer look at what a Trump presidency means for Appalachia. For many coal miners and their families, it means hope, pure and simple. Coal miner Jonathan Griffith describes what it was like inside the mine on election day.
It was such a big deal and a big day that, they had to announce over the radio, updates on who was winning, like what states was, winning for who.
Jonathan's a roof bolter from Garwood, West Virginia, not too far from where I grew up. He says that on election night, as state after state was called for Trump, the excitement grew.
You could just tell by the more throughout the night, everybody just got a little bit more productive and light at the end of the tunnel,
We're going to hear from Jonathan and his wife, Jessica, throughout the show. But first, we'll ask whether those miners have a reason to celebrate. Things are looking up for coal, at least a little bit. In the last few months, there's been a slight uptick in coal production caused by an increased demand for electricity and metallurgical coal, which is used to make steel. Even so, West Virginia mined only about 80 million tons last year, the lowest level in several decades. Roxy Todd asked two experts to predict the coal industry's future and how Trump's election may affect coal jobs.
The question you hear asked, around here a lot, and that is, will mining return, to what it was?
That's Chris Hamilton, vice president of the West Virginia Coal Association. In his 30-plus years there, he's seen a steady decline in coal jobs. But since 2012, it's been dramatic, with half of West Virginia's coal miners losing their jobs.
Well, words can't describe what some of our mining families are experiencing and going through here today.
About 11,000 coal mining jobs disappeared in West Virginia in the last 4 years. That's down from 21,000. The decline is equally bad in other parts of central Appalachia. Most of the hardest hit areas are in southern West Virginia, says John Deskins, an economist at West Virginia University.
And there are very few other industries, so a lot of people are looking for work, not very many other industries hiring. It's leading to a Great Depression-like economic environment in these southern coal fields in West Virginia.
Deskins says there are three main reasons coal has been declining in West Virginia in the last few years.
The first is the natural gas boom. And natural gas is an alternative. It's a competitor fuel to coal. So if natural gas prices are going down, then that hurts coal.
The second reason is decreased global demand for coal as the global economy, especially in China, has slowed. But that may be improving.
We think export demand is actually going to improve in coming years. We think that's going to happen with Trump. We thought that would have happened with Hillary.
The third major factor affecting coal is the regulatory climate. Trump has vowed to kill the Clean Power Plan, which would require coal-fired power plants to reduce carbon emissions. That may help coal, but Deskin says it won't bring back most of the lost jobs.
First and foremost, the Clean Power Plan is likely off the table with the Trump presidency. But, the Clean Power Plan wasn't in effect anyway. It was slated to begin in the early 2020s. So the elimination of the Clean Power Plan will definitely eliminate further downward pressure on coal demand, but it's not going to bring coal back.
Hamilton agrees. He believes Trump will do more for the coal industry than Clinton would have, but
with respect to mining, it probably is too optimistic to say we're going to return. So there's a lot of factors that play into that. Are we going to be able to regain, where we once were?
You can't go back.
Can't go back.
To what it was.
Cannot go back.
That's Chris Hamilton, vice president of the West Virginia Coal Association, speaking with Roxy Todd. At Donald Trump's campaign rally in West Virginia, Hamilton gave Trump an award, the white hard hat that said, Friends of Coal. Trump put on the hat, and at the same rally, he said,
We're going to put the miners back to work. We're going to put the miners back to work. We're going to get those mines open. Coal country.
This promise is the number one reason why coal miner Jonathan Griffith voted for Trump. I spoke with him and his wife at their home in Wyoming County, West Virginia.
Hopefully more jobs, the man talked about wanting to get more jobs in everywhere, and this state right here could need it. That we're basically if you ain't coal mining or railroad, then you're either on welfare or you got a college education. And I'm hoping that he can bring in something to help everybody, and I believe he will.
So what makes you think that Trump will be able to create these jobs here in southern West Virginia?
He's a smart man, you know. He's a billionaire, millionaire, whatever, and he's just really good at creating jobs. I hope so. I mean, the man says he's going to do it. I wouldn't like to call him a liar. I'd hope he'd stick to his guns like he said he was going to, so that's all I can hope for.
Well, now, politicians don't lie, do they?
Well, he's not a politician.
Jonathan didn't always vote for Republicans. In 2008, he says he voted for Obama, and he's a union miner, and unions tend to support Democrats.
I believe even the unions now are ready for a change.
It's early, but Jonathan says he's seeing a change for the better in his community. Coal stocks are up, the price of coal has increased some too. And here's one sign. Jonathan says inexperienced miners, including his brother-in-law, are finding work.
Red hats are finally getting, you know, to be able to get hired. And I haven't seen that since I was a red hat 5 years ago.
Jonathan just recently got his job back after he was laid off for about 7 months. And while he was called back to work, plenty of his friends and family were not. Getting rid of that worry would make him happier and healthier.
I wouldn't have to sit here and worry about if I'm going to have a job today or tomorrow and see if my 5 kids are going to eat or not. And that'd make me happy and keep me from stressing out. And, you know, when you get stressed out about worrying about if you have a job or not, you're, you know, something can happen. You know, you can be at work and thinking about it and something bad could happen and I might not come home.
Coming up next, we'll hear about why working class people in Appalachia and across the nation were attracted to Trump. You're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We're talking about what a Donald Trump presidency means for Appalachia. There's no denying that Appalachia went big for Trump. 69% of West Virginia voters picked Trump, the highest level of support in the country. He did nearly as well in Kentucky, Tennessee, and the Appalachian parts of Ohio and North Carolina. We've been hearing Jonathan Griffith share why he voted for Donald Trump. Griffith is a coal miner from southern West Virginia. Yes, it is the economy, but he says he voted for Trump because of his values and beliefs, too. He gets upset when he hears about what he calls younger kids protesting Trump by missing school and burning the American flag. It made him angry, especially since his wife and father-in-law served in the military.
It's very disrespectful for, you know, the people that fought for it and the people that, you know, hasn't fought for it. You know, I get to live my life on what the people did fight for, and I am grateful for that and for, you know, college kids, high school kids missing school, you know, people that can't even vote are crying and whining about this. It's very sickening.
To help us understand why Jonathan and so many other working class people in our region supported Trump, we turn to researcher Dr. Joan Williams. She spoke with Laurie Lynn and Scott Finn on West Virginia Public Broadcasting's podcast, The Front Porch, about the class culture gap.
One key element of the class culture gap that's relevant to the election is that white working class folks tend to admire the very rich, but really resent professionals. They resent professionals because these are the people who are ordering them around every day, often disrespectfully. This is the college kid who comes in and gets the job ahead of you and tells you how to do the job you've been doing for 30 years. This is the doctor who treats you like an idiot or condescends to you, the teacher who condescends to you and communicates that she feels better than you because she has more of an education. So a tremendous amount of resentment of professionals. On the other hand, the rich, that's what the white working class would like to be. They don't want to make all of the cultural changes that would be required for them to become professional families. They just want to be exactly the way they are, living their lives the way they've always lived them, with the values they've always had, but with more money. And so in many ways, Hillary Clinton represented to, I think, many Trump voters, the sort of condescension of professionals, whereas Trump represented their dream of, like, be just like I am, be able to do not mess with that political correctness nonsense, say what you want to say, say it in a direct way, but with the freedom of being a billionaire.
Then what a lot of people want is they want to have their same lives in the same way, but with more money. They saw in their parents, let's say, a certain way of life. The man is the breadwinner. The woman gets to stay home if she wants. And if they can't have exactly that, they're going to be upset. Well, that doesn't seem like – it doesn't seem very adult to me. That seems like almost like a childish reaction. If I can't have things exactly the way I want, I don't have to change. I don't want anything to be different. I just want more money. That doesn't seem like a very mature way of looking at the world. Am I being too harsh there?
I think you're just being elite there. I remember I was talking to one working class guy, and he said to me, "I associate change with loss," he said. And I went like, whoa, ain't that the truth? That's the attraction of stability, because change typically means loss. And that's what this whole class of people has seen over the past 20, 30, 40 years. Change has meant loss. And so I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday who lives in Georgia. She was saying, you know, what these people really are saying is that there's a whole lot of people here in the South who they had the three-bedroom home, the two baths, cinder block, very, very modest home, and they had full-time jobs, and they didn't do anything wrong, and now they're losing all of it. That does not strike me as whining. That strikes me as an exploited group, furious that they were given so little, they were satisfied with that little. And now that little is being taken away. These people aren't whining. These people are in pain because they had, for two short generations, they could live stable middle-class lives, and now they're losing that. We need to listen to this.
Well, I get that, but I want to push this just a little bit farther. I'm assuming that unless the laws of the world change in a substantial way, these trends that require people to have more education in order to have a decent life, I don't see them going the other way.
We have approached it with utter class cluelessness. We have said, if you want a stable life, get a college education. You know, that's what worked for me. I went to Yale, Harvard, and MIT. Hey, it worked great, you know, and my daddy paid the whole time. So what we're offering them is the ladder up that works for professionals, but we're not offering them any realistic ladder up that's going to work for people like them. And so they're just going like, I want what I had, I want what I had, I want what I had. What we should be offering them are programs that are modest in cost, located probably in community colleges, lead to certificates that are skilled jobs, but they don't require degrees in sociology. We keep saying to them, either you get a really good college education and become like us, or you're lazy, unambitious, and just whining that you wanted your father's life. No, we need to offer them something that's realistic for them. There was actually a study coming out from the Center for American Progress, which, as you know, is the kind of the Democrats' think tank in Washington, that showed that going to college, in many ways, economically, doesn't make a whole lot, a heck of a lot of sense for many kids in this class. We need to offer them something that will give them maybe not the nirvana of being a steel worker in the 1940s and 50s, but that gives them something other than a really, really dead-end job at minimum wage.
Joan, we seem to have become so much more irritated with each other on each side of this educated working class fault line. And I wonder if social media is playing a role in that at all. I mean, are we kind of in each other's face more, and does that make it worse?
You know, I think you're asking important questions, and I think the level of polarity has really, I mean, there's been studies that sharply increased in the United States such that people don't care if their kids marry somebody of a different race, but they really care if their kids marry someone of a different party. And people are much, much less likely to have friends from a different party than they were in past decades. Is it the problem that we're in each other's face more, or is it the problem that we have these hysterical echo chambers? As hysterical, I might add, on the left as on the right. I was talking to a young woman after Trump was elected who was just beside herself saying, oh, you know, I and my kids are going to end up in internment camps. And there's just on both sides, there are these echo chambers.
Here's the other thing that has to be asked. You say that people should avoid the temptation to write off blue-collar resentment as racism. Other people would say that they believe Donald Trump said things that were xenophobic, racist, and by voting for him, at the very least, they're tolerating that sort of sentiment. How do you respond to that?
I think it's complicated. I think Donald Trump certainly used open racism in his campaign. There's actually pretty robust history of that he has been a racist in a lot of his dealings. Since the election, there have been over, in the 10 days after the election, there were over 800 hate incidents. So he has certainly legitimized a level of racism and misogyny and xenophobia that is just so profoundly upsetting. All of that is true. On the other hand, to write off sort of the cri de coeur of the white working class as this is beneath our notice because it's mere racism, you know, that's dangerous because it isn't mere racism.
That's Dr. Joan Williams. Hear more of her interview on the Front Porch podcast at wvpublic.org. Williams talked about some of the cultural reasons white working class voters supported Trump. So how can Trump supporters justify statements from Trump that many find offensive, like this one about Mexicans?
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems. And they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people.
Or this one targeted at former Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly.
You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account
only
is
Rosie
several...
O'Donnell.
No, it wasn't.
She gets out and she starts asking me all sorts of ridiculous questions. And, you know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever.
I asked coal miner Jonathan Griffith and his wife Jessica about this. I was in their living room with them and their kids. And Jessica says Trump could have worded things a little differently, but...
I don't think he would ever do anything to actually hurt anybody like that. I think, you know, the media sometimes can twist stuff around, you know, to make it look like he's the bad guy, when all in all, you know, one of his main posts about or sayings about immigration and stuff, that he didn't say you couldn't come over here, he just said you have to do it the right way. And I think that's, you know, they just twisted it around to make him look like the bad guy. So, you know, I hope that was the case with that too. But I mean, they all say stuff that we don't like. I mean, that's just how it is, and you just got to pick the lesser of the two evils, you know.
But for other people from Appalachia, Trump's statements on Muslims, women, and immigrants disqualified him for the presidency. Sharif Youssef is the child of an Egyptian immigrant who grew up in the town of West Liberty, West Virginia. Now he works as a producer on the popular podcast 99% Invisible. After the election, Youssef spoke with Scott Finn and Rick Wilson, hosts of the Front Porch podcast, about the discrimination he faced as both an Arab American in Appalachia and later as an Appalachian American at Yale and San Francisco.
I think I have a very unique perspective on this election. I come from three very distinct places that I have ties to: Egypt, West Virginia, and Yale University. And all three are so distinct culturally as to be almost different countries. I tend to be very liberal, very progressive, and my Facebook feed is filled with other liberals and progressive thanks to Facebook's algorithms. So I saw a lot of heartache and disappointment after the election, and I felt that. I felt pretty terrified, not so much for me because I am white passing, but for my father, who teaches physics to people who don't really want to learn physics, so he already has some animosity built into his job, but also lives in a very rural area in West Liberty, West Virginia. I felt scared for my friends of color and for my queer, genderqueer, trans friends. And because I went to these liberal places like Yale and the Bay Area where I live now, I also see the sort of condescension that often is associated with West Virginia and Appalachia. When I told people I came from West Virginia at Yale, "Oh, you don't seem like a West Virginian," which was condescending because I knew that in their mind they had this really stereotypical vision of a West Virginian with like rotting teeth and morbidly obese and really dumb. And while I don't agree with that, I took it as a compliment that they didn't think I was that. Yeah, I just thought that perhaps sharing my perspectives on being discriminated against in West Virginia, perspectives of going to a liberal elite college and having similar condescension, showing that that stuff still exists outside of places that are more stereotypically discriminatory, I thought that unique perspective would be something that people would get some value and insight from.
Let me ask you about your experiences with people not being very tolerant of your religion when you were growing up in the Northern Panhandle. And what's it like? What actually happened to you?
I experienced everything from like people in middle school like following me around the hallways, calling me a terrorist, to more subtle things like during Ramadan, which I practiced in middle school. People would sort of go out of their way to like ask me, like, "Why are you doing this? Just eat something. Your dad won't know." And I'm like, "Oh, it's not about like whether my dad would know." They're like, "Oh, whatever." So having like your religion sort of cast aside, despite me not trying to like influence others to join it or whatever, was hurtful. I was harassed on the school bus going home. People would call me towelhead. People would call me like camel jockey. Some people would use worse words than that that I'm not sure if I should say on air. This unsettled feeling of never quite feeling at home is probably like the sense I get the most when I think about that stuff happening.
I was wondering how your experience changed at specific critical times, for example, around 9/11. Was it an issue before that in your memory? I know you're not as old as I am in the buildup of the Iraq War. You know, just how did it fluctuate in terms of public events?
Sure. I would say 9/11 was definitely a catalyzing point. That happened when I was in fourth grade, and then middle schools was fifth grade to eighth grade. So I remember like most distinctly in middle school, partly because in middle school it got a bunch of different elementary schools sending all the kids to the same place. So maybe the people in fourth grade who like knew me better and knew that like I didn't have a hateful bone in my body might have been more tolerant. And then in middle school, getting other people in, hearing the name Sharif Youssef, looking at my dark features, like my dark eyebrows, my dark hair, I think that was definitely a catalyst.
So your dad still lives here. You've moved out to the Bay Area to a very successful career as a producer. Does your dad have a different view of living in West Virginia than you do? Because you seem to have a pretty dismal view of the place based on how you were treated while you were growing up here.
Dismal in some senses, but like the community that I did have were really kind and friendly, and people like often went out of their way to say hi to each other, and I really appreciated that. My dad like ran over a small rock in his car with me in it, and like our tire went flat, and someone saw us and like took us to their house, and they had like a garage filled with tools and helped change the tire. That's stuff that is like really special to me that you can't find just anywhere. And that's something that I really do love about West Virginia. But I talked to my father and his wife, Linda, on the phone, my stepmother. He's not like a very social person. Like he pretty much works and then stays home and plays with the cats. So he doesn't have to interact with a whole lot of people that he doesn't have to. But I've seen people like look at him with like, I don't know, shady eyes in Kroger. So I know like that stuff exists towards him. But I think first generations or immigrants in particular have a different view of racism because they're just like more used to it. So I think he does have a view of like, okay, this might be like a tough 4 years. One thing that he said that was pretty profound that I hadn't really thought about, he's like, I grew up in Egypt where Hosni Mubarak had been reigning for many years. And he was just like, I just had to accept that. We didn't really have a say in what happened. We just had to accept corrupt leaders if they were thrust upon us. Despite the election not going the way he would have wanted, he was like, it's kind of cool that in a democratic republic, something won't go your way pretty frequently, but at least you have a say in it. And that was something that I didn't really think about too much because I was too young to think about politics when I did live in Egypt.
Sharif, there's been a lot of commentary about Trump voters, obviously, and Jamel Bowie from Slate has an article that's entitled "There's No Such Thing as a Good Trump Voter," and basically says that people voted for a racist who promised racist outcomes and they don't deserve your empathy.
Yeah, I have already skimmed that article, and I also read another article from, I think, a professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison who actually went to rural communities and sat with them for longer than like an hour and kept going back and talking to them and hearing what they had to say about the divide between rural and urban. And I honestly, like, don't know. I think understanding people regardless of politics is really important. This has been helpful talking to you guys who are still in West Virginia to, like, understand your perspective on things. Hopefully hearing mine are illuminating in some way, too. But at the same time, like, Trump espoused so much hatred, like, not even remotely censored, like, admitting to sexual assault, creating a national registry for people who have a different religion, banning all immigration, deporting millions of people. So, like, in a way, I do see that as, like, voting for him as implicit condoning of his behavior. But to be honest, I think the narrative of, like, it was poor, racist white people who elected Trump to president is false. Hillary Clinton, the only income brackets that she won were people who made 50 grand or less a year. But every other income bracket voted for Trump. So I think, like, not everyone who voted for Trump was a racist. I think some of the people were, for sure. But I think a lot of people saw that, like, he was just using rhetoric to gain bigoted support that he needed to win the election. And then it was other people who were like, okay, he probably won't actually be able to do a lot of this stuff, but I'm going to vote for him because it will decrease my taxes. I think that is also a narrative that's not getting enough play in the media.
That's Sharif Youssef, West Virginia native, Arab American, and Trump critic. Today, we're hearing folks in our region share how they feel about Donald Trump becoming president. Next, let's hear from a woman who says she was a reluctant supporter of Trump. Republican Patricia Rucker is one of just three women elected to the West Virginia Senate in 2016. She's a former teacher who homeschools her five children. She's also an immigrant from Venezuela.
I do believe that the United States is a great country with opportunities for everyone. I would hope that we would not allow the divisiveness of certain people or groups to break up what really made this nation wonderful, which is it is a nation of immigrants.
So what does she think about President Trump and all of his remarks about Latinos and immigrants on the campaign trail?
I have to admit that after a lot of struggle, I did end up voting for Donald Trump. I just was not 100% sure that Donald Trump was going to stay true to, you know, what he said he would do. And, you know, he's so new to the political arena. And obviously, we've all heard, you know, that he has not been the greatest speaker. He has not said things like I would ever say. And some of his opinions I completely disagree with.
Rucker says she would have loved to have had a female president, just not Hillary Clinton.
Her threats to West Virginia coal, her promise to basically make gun ownership much harder. I mean, those are things that I just could not possibly ever support.
So Patricia Rucker voted for Trump, even though she recognizes his weaknesses. Reverend Ronald English voted against Trump, even though he admits to Trump's strengths.
In a strange kind of way, Trump was like King.
Huh?
In terms of touching the emotion that he felt and knew was there and firing it into a movement.
English can talk about Martin Luther King with some authority. He worked with King for several years. Now he's a Baptist preacher in Charleston, West Virginia. And that guy you heard asking, huh? Well, that's Trey Kay, host and producer of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's podcast, Us and Them. He asked English if he felt anxious over Trump's election.
I've felt that I have personally, and I've noticed other people who have had a lot of anxiety and difficulty with this election. Before the election, I found that my anxiety was higher than it normally was. I was angry with people, lashing out with people, you know, getting into, like, screaming my head off at some points. So my first question would be, have you had to speak or pastor people with regard to any anxiety regarding this election?
No, not in the sense that you just described. Barack Obama's election was suggesting that we had arrived at a place of equality. We had not dealt with the undercurrent of racism that had run through this nation.
I was surprised by the result of the election. It doesn't sound like you were surprised.
Not really. The reason I'm not surprised is because the reality of racism weaving in the very fabric of what it is to be in this country is something I was just expecting would show up in terms of a reaction, and it happened to be in this particular way.
I have to tell you, I loved the service yesterday, and I loved the message, focusing on this idea of prepare ye the way of the Lord.
But Isaiah, as the prophet, is saying right there where you are, in the wilderness, that's where I want you to prepare a way for the Lord.
Amen. Amen.
Make straight in the desert a highway for our God.
Is there a message in there that can speak to those of us who are just having a difficult time acclimating to these difficult times?
What the text really says is that I'm coming into the wilderness. Whatever situation of wilderness we are in, whatever moment of darkness we are in, we've been here before, after the Civil War. And something comes out of the Civil War that brings about a new creation. You don't anticipate how it's going to happen. You really don't know how it's going to happen. And that's my hope in terms of how this may be the evening of a awakening that was not intended by what brought Trump into office. And the biblical perspective on that is that we really don't know what the darkness is hiding. It may very well be that the darkness is hiding a glory that we just can't see. And I've never even thought about it before until now. But in a strange kind of way, Trump was like King.
Huh?
In terms of touching the emotion that he felt and knew was there and firing it into a movement that brought about a critical change in the country. But it's not about intellect. It's about emotion. And he was able to speak to that emotion of folk who felt like they were unheard and abused and misused. And because of that, he becomes their, not only their spokesperson to speak for them, but their hero and now their president. That's how I'm talking about them being, you know, kind of similar in terms of how they responded to a mood that led into a movement.
That was Reverend Ronald English. You can hear more on the Us and Them podcast. Find it at wvpublic.org. We're talking today about what a Trump presidency means for Appalachia. And one question is, what will happen to coal miners with black lung? A provision in the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, made it easier for miners with the disease to get medical care. And if the Affordable Care Act is repealed, well, it's unclear what happens to black lung victims. Come to find out, black lung is making a comeback. More miners are being diagnosed with the disease, even as the federal government has failed to keep an accurate count, according to an investigation by NPR's Howard Berkus. Here's black lung victim Mackie Branham of Elkhorn Creek, Kentucky. He's just 39 years old.
Me, I've never been scared of death. It don't bother me a bit. It's just not seeing my kids grow up. But if I had it to do over, I would do it again, if that's what it took to provide for my family as long as I have.
We asked West Virginia Senator Shelley Moore Capito what Congress and the Trump administration should do about black lung. Capito spoke with hosts Rick Wilson and Lori Lynn on West Virginia Public Broadcasting's The Front Porch podcast.
So I think the crux of the report that I read at NPR is that there's something maybe new happening here with our younger miners. I just met this week with probably 10 people who are afflicted with black lung who are concerned about the continuation of the benefit that they have now. And I'm certainly committed to that, have been, and will continue to be. And also for their widows. Some of them meet early deaths because of this, and they're concerned about their families as they move on. And that's a concern I hold as well. I think that, you know, safer conditions are always something that we need to move forward on. MSHA just went forward with a lower coal dust standard. That's a human tragedy that we just heard, and it's sad. The sad part, I think, for all of us and for me as well, is when he states that he would do it all over again, even though he's struggling for breath. And I don't know that that's a situation that we want to keep enforcing, that that's what you're going to do everything no matter what. We shouldn't have that.
So on a related question, first, thanks for supporting the Miners Protection Act. I'm just curious what you think the prospects for that are in the coming year.
You know, I think they're good. I'm really disappointed, Rick, in the way the whole thing shook out in the end. We couldn't push it any further than 4 months, which is a huge disappointment. And as I talked to those miners, they were disappointed. They did seem to understand that we can live to fight another day. So what we need to do is attack this earlier. McConnell did say on the floor of the Senate that he doesn't see any reason why this shouldn't be able to be taken care of. I couldn't believe they want to hear us fight about it again, because we're going to have so much going on in the spring. So I'm optimistic, but cautiously so, because we've been optimistic before.
Senator, West Virginians voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump, almost 69% more than any other state. So I think it's fair to say that expectations are high. What can West Virginians hope for from a Trump administration?
I think West Virginians felt taken advantage of, overlooked, underappreciated, and really not as being a part of, over the last 8 years, haven't felt like they've been a part of this future for their children and their grandchildren. And it was reflected in everybody's vote. And I think President-elect Trump tapped into this, not just in West Virginia, but in a lot of different places. If we move, I think, in a reasonable fashion, he moves in a reasonable fashion to sort of unleash some of the regulations that are holding back some of our energy jobs. But I think we all realize it's not going to come back to where it is. And I don't think people who are in the business for many years believe that to be true, or miners. I think that President-elect Trump shouldn't try. This is hard for him to not overpromise, because I think that just will breed discontent quickly. But I do think that the other message was, we're ready to shake it up, and we're going to risk. Maybe we don't like everything about this guy, and maybe the way he presents certain things, but we're willing to risk this because the status quo hasn't worked for us, and Washington isn't working.
That's West Virginia Senator Shelley Moore Capito speaking on West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Front Porch podcast. Appalachia supported Trump in part because the region is hurting. Lifespans in many parts of Appalachia are declining. West Virginia has the highest drug overdose rate in the country. The federal agency with the mandate to help fix some of those problems is the Appalachian Regional Commission, or ARC. I asked the ARC co-chairman, Earl Gohl, what should happen next.
It's so critical for communities to look and understand that they have assets beyond coal, to look and understand that the folks who live in their communities have more skills, have more ability than just to do one job.
The ARC helps distribute money for infrastructure throughout the region, such as a network of four-lane highways slicing through the mountains. Trump has promised to spend more on infrastructure, and Gohl says Appalachia needs more roads, more water and sewer systems, and especially more access to high-speed internet. And despite all our region's challenges, Gohl encourages us not to lose sight of our opportunities.
People can talk, or folks can focus on the woes of Appalachia. My approach has really been to focus on the opportunities in Appalachia, and I would argue something very different. My message to folks who live in Appalachian communities is that Appalachia really is has the potential of being the next great investment opportunity in America.
That was Appalachian Regional Commission Federal Co-Chair Earl Gohl talking about the needs and the potential of Appalachia. So how will Appalachia react to the start of the Trump administration? 100 Days in Appalachia is a new project to tell those stories from inside our region, a place that's been dubbed Trump Nation. It's a collaboration between West Virginia University's Reed College of Media, West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and The Daily Yonder. Managing editor Dave Mistich says the project is designed to burst the filter bubble of social news.
Scroll through your Facebook feed and sometimes it's hard to tell what is and isn't real and what's trying to bait you in with a headline. And of course, that's not to say that there's not a lot of really great reporting out there in the world right now. I think what this project was aiming to do is do really great reporting focused on a particular region and focused on the new administration in the context of all of what's going on social media and online, too.
So what kind of stories are important to cover within the first 100 days in Appalachia for this project?
Right. Well, I think that to some degree, it's going to be a little reactive in seeing what the Trump administration does, and particularly the way they handle some of the issues facing Appalachia, like the opioid crisis, like his promise to bring coal jobs back. We're looking at a bunch of really interesting things. One in particular that I don't think anyone's really discussed yet is the fact these national pollsters and national political forecasters like Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball, 538, or the New York Times, they seem to miss the mark on predicting the way some of these big swing states should go. The Pennsylvanias, the Ohios, the Michigans, the Floridas. But one of the things that hasn't been discussed yet, and we're trying to take a look at, is the fact that these pollsters and forecasters seem to get Appalachia nearly spot on, at least the heart of Appalachia, the West Virginias, Kentucky, Tennessee. And what I'm really interested in finding out is whether or not Appalachia could be considered a bellwether to any degree in predicting the way the rest of the country might vote. There's been a lot of conversations about rural America and the role that that played in pushing Donald Trump to a win. And obviously Appalachia, being as rural as it is, certainly plays some role in that. So I think that there's a lot to be said about this region, particularly in the context of the election, and what that all means for the rest of the country.
So the people who are telling these stories, it's going to be people who are knowledgeable of this region, who have expertise in this area, who are also seasoned journalists, professionals as well. Why is it important to have people reporting on Appalachia that are familiar with this region?
I think that people here have a perspective about the region. They care about it very deeply in ways that, and I'm not making an accusation or indictment here of the national media, but I think that people here care about these stories
so much and getting them right and all the nuance that's involved in these stories, that sort of level of expertise and insight is going to be crucial to telling these stories. We're going to be using folks and material and content from West Virginia Public Broadcasting, as well as working with the folks from the Daily Yonder to collaborate as well. And given those the experience and in depth and institutional knowledge of the region, just between those two entities and as well as WVU, I think that provides a platform to dive deeply into some of these stories in ways that a journalist that's coming in from California or New York or anywhere else across the country or around the world might not be able to have.
That's West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Dave Mistich, managing editor of 100 Days in Appalachia. Find a link at our website at wvpublic.org. After the election, I felt torn. A lot of people I know, family, friends, neighbors, felt ecstatic over Trump's election. Meanwhile, I know lots of people who believe that anyone who voted for Trump is deplorable. So I wanted to tell the story of Jonathan and Jessica Griffith because people in the coalfields deserve better. They're intelligent, well-informed, and accepting of people who are different from them. During my visit, Jessica bounces their baby boy on her knee, and Jonathan rummages through the cabinets looking for things to pack in his lunch bucket. He's worked for about 5 years underground as a roof bolter. It's considered one of the most dangerous jobs. It's also one of the best paying.
Life of a coal miner is pretty rough. There's nights you come home and you're tired. You really just don't want to do nothing, sleep and, you know, go back to work. But then there's nights, you know, you have to make yourself, you know, spend time with the family.
It's like you're a single parent a lot of times because he's just not there. You know, they work 6 days a week, sometimes 12 hours a day, and then by the time they sleep, it's time to start over. Like our older three kids, he don't even see them till the weekends because they're gone when he's asleep, and by the time they get home from school, he's gone back to work, and it makes it tough, especially all the running you have to do by yourself with five of them.
Jonathan's dad didn't want him to become a coal miner. Jonathan doesn't want any of his five boys to become miners either. Jonathan and Jessica hope they can use this coal mining money to get them a college education.
I kind of contradict myself. I'm trying to talk myself into hoping my kids don't get into it because it is a dangerous job. You try to make it as safe as you can, but it is. It's very dangerous, and I don't want my kids doing it. I couldn't imagine my kids doing it. You know, like I said, I do it because, yeah, I do like it, but the money's good.
Jonathan was laid off for about 7 months last year. He says if he gets laid off again, he'll go back to school and try to get away from the mining industry.
It's not that I don't like it. I love being a coal miner. I love my job. It's just, it gets tiring. Like I mentioned earlier, you know, sometimes you come home, you'll sleep all day long, and you hate doing it, and then there's sometimes you sleep and you're fine. And I'd really like to spend more time with my kids and family, and if I could find a better paying job to do that, yeah, I'd be gone.
Do you know what you'd want to study?
Culinary arts. I'd go into cooking. That was my thing when I was laid off. I enjoyed doing.
So why not now? It's a question I've read on social media and in stories. Well, the Griffiths did think about moving. They weighed their options and looked at moving to Alabama when he was laid off.
I mean, it's hard to pick up and leave, you know, to take your kids away from their friends and from, you know, from their family that they're close to. And then the cost of living in other places is a lot higher also. So you think of trying to buy a new house and then, you know, would we still be able to survive on income? Would I have to get a job too? And then you have to pay for daycare. So, you know, there's a lot of factors. It ain't just like, oh, well, we can just pick up and move. There's a lot to it.
So the Griffiths, like so many other coal country families, fight to keep what they have.
A lot of people talked about coal mines like it's eventually going to be gone and, you know, stuff like that. And yeah, one day it probably will be, but, you know, you got to work what you got, why you got it. And people are like, well, why do you want to vote for somebody that you know, says that they can save it and you don't know. But, you know, when you're looking at somebody, say you're starving to death and you have two people and one's like, I'm not going to give you food no matter what, no matter what you're going to do. And the other person's like, yeah, you know, you come with me, I'm going to provide food for you. I mean, obviously you're going to choose the one that says, you know, they're going to give you the food, even though they might not. Like, you're going to take that chance because you want it and stuff, rather than just being like, okay, I'm not doing it at all. And that's how I looked at it.
That's Jessica Griffith, stay-at-home mom, veteran, and coal miner's wife. Her husband, Jonathan, has been an underground coal miner in southern West Virginia for about 5 years. On this show, we've spoken to supporters and opponents of Trump in Appalachia to find out what it means for our future and what we should be watching. They have a story just the same as anyone else. These folks have done their own research and looked for answers that made sense for their lives. This election was such a surprise to some people, but maybe it wouldn't have been if we just listened to a different viewpoint. Get to know somebody who's a different religion or race or registered as a different political party or someone in a different tax bracket. Or maybe even the man you see at the gas station, covered in coal dust. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Us and Them podcast and the Front Porch podcast. Music in today's show was provided by Jake Sheps, Andy Agnew Jr., and Ben Townsend. Scott Finn edited our show this week. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.